opinions in very easy cold blood. So we're not facing only army. We're facing a crazy settlers, groups of crazy people who just want to kill more and more. And the idea is clear. They want to empty West Bank from Palestinians. Guys, what is happening in Gaza? What is happening in West Bank? We say it again and again. This was planned from 80 years, and the Israelis have the time to work on it slowly to displaced Palestinians in Palestine. They want Palestine empty from Palestinians, and that's the only plan. And they will not relax. They will not stop until this happened, or inshallah, it will be victory for Palestinians and they will get defeated.
Ahmed Tabassi, there have been more than 10,000 Palestinians on the West Bank arrested since October 7th. We have brought out reports from CNN to Human Rights Watch to Haaretz to Admir of prisoners who haven't been charged, being sexually abused, being tortured. I'm wondering if you can talk about the effect of this level of imprisonment, and particularly this past December, the Israeli forces raided the offices of your theater, of the Jenin Freedom Theater. Producer Mustafa Shetha was detained and sentenced to 6 months. Have you heard from him? Has he seen a lawyer? Has he been accused?
Exactly, that's what I'm talking about, Emmy. I had an interview with your program in December, last December, and it's the same and even more crazy. Mustafa still in prison, no information, not allowed even for lawyers to visit or have any information. As we said before, even kids in the Freedom Theater being shot where they were playing. So for me, it's like, is really American people, American governments know what is going on? Are they really following? We have been saying this years and years, again and again, tons of report, United Nations, tons of report. And what is next? We still, that's why Israelis going on there. That's why they're getting, and I'm sure the Israelis could not do this if they do not have the green light from the U.S. government. I am saying from your window, from your program, I'm calling to the American people, to the American artists, to the American activists, to the American people, please, you are the one who have to move now and stop this craziness. You have to stop supporting sending bombs to Israel. Enough military support. This military support goes for killing artists, children, destroying theaters, killing people, killing women. They do nothing more than this. And the peace that Israel is looking for is not to have a peace in Palestine. It's to control all the world. It's to occupy the whole Middle East and use it for the political situation that U.S. tried to fight China and Iran and Russia in Palestine. We need to do something. It's not only Palestinian left alone to deal with the Israeli occupation that is defending West and Europe. U.S., it's really in a very difficult situation. If the U.S. do not follow the time and do something before this will be out of time, I think American people have to explain to the next generation. American people have to explain to the a new generation in America what they did to the Palestinians, what they did to save and to finish this genocide and war. Guys, you will have a big responsibility in the future to define what happened to the Palestinians from the American support to the Israeli military terrorism people.
Ahmed Tabassi, we want to thank you for being with us, artistic director at the Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp, speaking to us from Jenin. Next up, in Afghanistan, the Taliban approves a law banning women from speaking in public. Stay with us.
Del que dispara de lejos, del que apretó el botón rojo y no se atrevió a mirarme a los ojos bajo los escombros se reescribieron las historias que no se han contado están los libros que nunca leyeron los soldados que nos bombardearon.
Oh,
Los Escombros, Under the Rubble by Residente and Amal Mercus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban has approved a wide-ranging law that forces women to completely cover their bodies, including their faces, and remain silent in public. The law will be enforced by the morality police, who work under the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. The law codifies many rules that have been in place since the Taliban returned to power 3 years ago. The law has been widely condemned. This is Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
These are partners who are being completely silenced, and they're attempting to render them into shadows. Their voices are no longer permissible. Education is no longer permissible. You cannot even see their faces. This needs to stop, and we need to continue talking about it. We need to continue advocating for it and putting pressure on the authorities to listen.
Afghan women have been defying the Taliban's edicts and videos posted on social media or shared with human rights groups. This woman living inside Afghanistan concealed her identity as she recorded herself singing, "You have silenced my voice until further notice. You have imprisoned me in my home for the crime of being a woman."
مرا با جرم زن بودن اسیر خانه ام کردی چه کس باید دهد اکنون غذای کون.
For more, we're joined by Seema Samar, an Afghan human rights advocate and medical doctor. She was chairperson of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission from 2002 to 2019. She also briefly served as Minister of Women's Affairs in the Afghan interim government in 2002. In 2012, she was awarded the Right Livelihood Award in recognition of her work on women's rights. She's now a visiting scholar at Tufts University. Her memoir published earlier this year, titled Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. Seema Samar, welcome back to Democracy Now! How sad, ironic, that your book is called Outspoken, when the Taliban have now said women cannot speak in public. Can you respond exactly what this law is and what it means?
Thank you so much, Amy. It's nice to be in your show. Thank you for having me here. Yes, I think this law further restricts all the rights that the woman had. They already put a lot of restriction on women's rights. They were not able to go get education. They were not able to work outside of the house. They were not able to travel alone without male mahram. They were not able to walk with open faces. But I mean, still the Afghan women were resisting on those. But this law further restricts the rights and freedom of all the people, but particularly the women. They cannot even raise their voice, even if they recite Quran. You cannot see such a law in any other regime in this planet. So I think it is the full isolation, systematic erase of women from public life. And as we call it, it's gender apartheid. I think they, with this law, they completed gender apartheid. I don't know why the people around us, the international community, do not see this. And it's also was a reaction to the endorsement of the Taliban in Doha 3. Because if you remember, Doha 3 was the meeting earlier, 6 weeks ago, in Doha with the Taliban. And a price that they brought the Taliban spokesperson and representative in Doha to meet with all the representatives of the international communities, and the United Nations organized this, and they refused to add the civil society and women's group to the main meeting. After a lot of pressure, we just put on the UN. They said, okay, at the end of the actual meeting, they will see some people from civil society. So this was a policy trying to normalize the Taliban. So this law is a reaction an answer to the normalization of the United Nations and some other countries who tries to say that the Taliban are the reality of Afghanistan. And I would say, yes, the Taliban are the reality of Afghanistan, but millions and millions of people and women in Afghanistan is also reality. And this is a crime against humanity. It is gender apartheid. You don't have any other name. I'm sorry, I heard the news about the Middle East. What I see, it's the continuation of culture of impunity everywhere.
Dr. Sama, if you could also just comment, you mentioned gender apartheid, which is, of course, what many are saying, the Taliban have created a state of gender apartheid in Afghanistan. But what's your sense of how other people, ordinary Afghans, are responding to these measures? A recent survey found that almost 70% want women's rights to be a central, important feature of the focus of the government. If you could respond.
Yeah, actually, they have a regime of fear and oppression. They treat people with the gunpoint. That's why they're so violent, and nobody has a law and nobody is accountable. So that's why the people are not getting out of the house or protesting against this. I keep saying that it is not the problem of the women, actually, in Afghanistan. It is the problem of every household. What the people could say and do, I think they have to stand more strongly and use their civil rights and start protesting against this inhuman, un-Islamic, and all, against all the international law and principles, and against all the obligation of Afghanistan towards all these conventions of human rights, and the violation, clear violation of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Because practically, their voice cannot be heard by any man who is not related, maybe including the in-laws. I mean, it's a new style of slavery, in my view.
Seema Samar, if you can explain, I just want to say you were head of the Ministry of Women's Affairs very briefly. The Ministry for Women has now been changed into the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. The new law, the new decree includes women must veil themselves in front of all men, even in front of non-Muslim women. It also permits brutal physical punishment, beating, intimidation, imprisonment without due process. Where do you see this all going right now?
I think they want to show that their actual opinion, because there were some people advocating for the Taliban that they are changed. They learned from their past mistakes. But I think it is really the responsibility, not only of the Afghan people. Of course, we have more responsibility than the others, to raise awareness about the situation in Afghanistan and to make it serious, to look serious. I think it's not only the problem in Afghanistan, it's going to spread in the other countries, particularly on the regional countries. We already see sign of this kind of behavior and empowerment of patriarchy in the region. So,
who is financially backing the Taliban?
Unfortunately, everybody, because they get some money. This is, I don't know the exact number or amount. They're getting money from different intelligence services claiming that they are fighting against Daesh. And every week, there is $40 million going to Afghanistan in order to keep the
claiming that they're fighting against ISIS, you mean?
Yes, yes. And so that is really, and they also have contract and get a lot of money from the mining in Afghanistan, and they put different kind of taxes on people. Even the tax is not really has a rule. The inspector police or the Sharia inspector, what they call it, the Muftasid, they call it, they have the right to punish the people and take as much as they have to pay. The people who, the farmers, it's not, unfortunately, the environment is too bad, too bad, and the people doesn't have a lot of income from their farming.
Well, Sina, we have to leave it there, but we thank you so much for being with us, and of course, we'll continue to follow this issue. Seema Samar, Afghan human rights advocate, medical doctor, chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission from 2002 to 2019, briefly served as Minister of Women's Affairs in the interim government of Afghanistan in 2002, was awarded the Right Livelihood Award for recognition of her work with women's rights now at Tufts University. Her memoir is called Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. Next up, Russia continues its largest aerial assault since the invasion as Ukrainian forces push deeper into Russia. We'll be back in 30 seconds.
در گذرگاه آتش در کنار آزادی گلش گفته خواهد شد گلش گفته خواهد شد یک بهار آزادی من سرود خواهم خواند بار بار آزادی بار
Women singing in protest of the Taliban's newly approved law that forces women to completely cover their bodies, including their faces, and remain silent in public. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the war in Ukraine as Russia continues its largest aerial assault since invaded the country in 2022. This week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he hoped to present President Joe Biden with a plan for victory when he visits the United States for the UN General Assembly next month, but he's ruled out any immediate ceasefire with Russia. The Kremlin has dismissed the plan. Meanwhile, as Ukrainian forces press their counteroffensive deeper into Russia, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency toured Russia's Kursk nuclear facility Tuesday. IAEA chief Rafael Grossi warned of the heightened risk of a nuclear catastrophe and said the aging Soviet-era nuclear plant's reactors are not protected by containment domes often found in modern facilities, making them more vulnerable in an attack.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Berlin, Vladimir Slivyak is with us, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense. He won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, the Alternative Nobel, for defending the environment and mobilizing grassroots opposition to Russia's coal and nuclear industries. And in Washington, D.C., Matt Duss is with us, executive vice president of the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Vladimir Slivyak. This extreme situation at the Kursk nuclear plant, the head of the IAEA has said that it is an old plant that doesn't have much of the safety mechanisms. Can you explain what's happening there? That's in Russia. It's been invaded by Ukraine in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and also what's happening with Zaporizhia, which is in Ukraine, but it's occupied by Russia right now, and it's the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. Vladimir.
Hi, Amy. Thank you very much for having me on the show. So the situation near Kursk nuclear plant is getting worse and worse. Basically every day there is fighting between Russian and Ukrainian army. It was officially said it was in a few kilometers from a nuclear power plant. And today, Russian army already said that Ukrainians been trying to get into the city that is next to a nuclear power plant where the workers from the plant are living. And it's true that it's very old reactors. It's very similar to the one that exploded back in 1986 in Chernobyl, causing the largest nuclear accident in humankind history. And right now, situation, you can call it worst of the worst. for the reason that those are very old reactors. It's not protected, but containment. For example, Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine, it's more protected. I mean, the reactors itself. In Kursk, reactors are not protected, and basically any big rocket, missile, or the bomb dropped on a reactor itself may lead to a very big nuclear accident. I wouldn't say it's going to be second Chernobyl, but it could be very, very big with a radioactive release approaching a few countries that are close to Russia.
Matt Duss, if you could respond to what Zelensky hopes to do, meeting with Biden when he comes to the U.S. next month, also hoping to meet with Trump and Kamala Harris.
Well, I think what he wants to do with Biden is to continue to increase the level of support, the quality of armament that the United States has been providing since the beginning of this war in February 2022. President Biden, in my view, has taken a fairly restrained approach to the level and quality of support that he's given to the Ukrainian military, steadily increasing that as the Ukrainian military shows that it's capable of using those arms productively. I think there's going to be some tension here because I think, again, President Biden has been pretty cautious and been criticized, including by some voices in Washington, D.C., about being too cautious about the possibility of an escalation. Certainly, no one wants to see a nuclear escalation, which would be catastrophic. But there is some, I think, difference of opinion about the utility right now of Ukraine's incursion into Russia. Although I think many are impressed with what they've been able to achieve after 2 years of a solely defensive war.
Matt, if you can talk more about what has taken place, this huge change in the last weeks with Ukraine invading Russia, not clear how Putin will respond and how he's responded so far, and Zelensky saying at this point he's not interested in any discussion of a ceasefire or any kind of peace deal.
Right. Well, I think what we've seen over the past months before this incursion was Ukraine being a bit more aggressive in the way it was striking sites inside Russia, specifically sites that were used to launch rocket and drone attacks inside Ukraine. They were restrained from doing that for a long time by their U.S. and European partners out of escalation concerns. Once again, I think reasonable escalation concerns given the nuclear aspect here. But I think they showed that those escalation concerns may have been slightly overblown given Russia's relatively muted response to those attacks. And once again, I think we should note that attacking sites being used to launch missiles, rockets, and drones into Ukraine is a pretty legitimate tactic. But what we've seen just over the past week is, actual U.S. Ukrainian military forces invading into Russia. The first time, I believe, since World War II that Russia's territory has been invaded by a foreign army. And I think part of the approach here is, again, to kind of turn the tables and show that Russia is not immune to these incursions. It's certainly a propaganda loss for President Vladimir Putin, though it's hard to say what Russians are actually seeing given the almost complete control that the Russian government has over what Russians are allowed to see in their media. But I do think just taking the initiative, as we saw about a year and a half ago in the first counteroffensive, I think that's one benefit of this, is for just Ukraine to show that it is not simply on its back foot and defending. It is now taking the initiative and taking the fight into Russia.
Vladimir, if you could speak about the Rosatom State Corporation, which is the Russian state corporation focused on nuclear energy, and its role in the occupation of Zaporizhzhia, Russia having replaced France now as the world's leading player in international nuclear power plant production.
Well, first of all, it's not just a nuclear corporation. It's a military organization. It's part of a Russian government. and it's in charge of a nuclear weapon and so-called civil nuclear power in Russia. But it's also being used by Vladimir Putin as an instrument of geopolitical fight around the world. Russia's going around to different developing countries, proposing them to build new nuclear power plants of Russian design, even giving them loans, because most of the developing countries cannot pay such a big sums of money, because, one Russian nuclear power plant with, let's say, two reactors in it would cost over $10 billion of American dollars, and not many developing countries can afford it. So Russians would just loan this money to other countries, and in exchange they get, basically economic control and some sort of political control over those countries. Because once you sign up with a Russian Rosatom to build reactor in your country, you get into dependence. It's dependence on Russian engineers, Russian technologies, supplying of Russian fuel, nuclear fuel, and also when the nuclear plant will go offline because it's old, you will be dependent on decommissioning technology, which is also coming from Russia. And we're talking about roughly 100 years or even 120 years, No nuclear power expansion that Rosatom is doing around the world under order of Vladimir Putin. It's expansion because Vladimir Putin wants more control over developing world. It wants to use developing world in his, opposition to the West, I would say.
And we also have to say that the Kursk nuclear power plant is similar to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which melted down in 1986. Matt, just before we go, at the Democratic National Convention, we bumped into you. We were covering the uncommitted sit-in that took place there, and it was around U.S. policy around Gaza. From Ukraine to Gaza, if you could comment on the Harris Walls policy, we're going to know a lot more tonight, maybe, in their first sit-down interview. And Vance and Trump, Vance, who said in 2022, I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or the other.
Yeah. I mean, what we heard from Vice President Harris in her speech, she didn't talk about foreign policy a lot, but Ukraine and Ukraine and Israel-Palestine were two issues she did touch on. She said that the United States would continue to support Ukraine's defense against the Russian invasion. She was very clear about that. And on Israel and Palestine, you know, she said the usual things about continuing to support Israel's right to defend itself, but she also lifted up the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and very strongly reiterated support for Palestinians' right to freedom and self-determination. Now, that language was unsatisfying for a lot of people, myself included. I wish she could have leaned into it a bit more, but I do think it's worth noting that this is the first time we've heard that kind of language from a candidate for president from the Democratic Party in their speech, their acceptance speech at the convention. So again, while I expect the uncommitted movement and other allies to continue pushing on this, I think it's worth just noting that. Now from Vance and Trump, yes, as you said, Trump, as you know, has been kind of a fan of Putin for a long time, doesn't seem to really care about Ukraine. Vance himself has suggested that our support for Ukraine is distracting from the real enemy, which is China. I think that's a pretty consistent approach between Trump and Vance. They see China as the new big enemy and Ukraine as more of a distraction.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. So much more has to be discussed, but we have to leave it there. Matt Duss, Executive Vice President of the Center for International Policy, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Vladimir Slivyak, co-chair of the Russian environmental organization EcoDefense, who won the 2021 Right Livelihood Award, speaking to us from Berlin, Germany. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently hiring a camera operator to work during our live TV broadcast. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for